Your Majesties, eminent scientists, distinguished guests, it's a real privilege to be here and to be asked to share with you some of what I've learned over the last 30 years about how music is uniquely human, as Professor Honing said, and how music is actually medicine, not metaphorically, but the evidence that's been accumulated in thousands of peer-reviewed studies over the last 10, primarily over the last 10 years, that music has profound effects on the mind, the body, and the spirit. When I was getting ready to publish my book on music as medicine, I asked AI to make me a Dutch master's rendition of the notion of music and medicine. I spent the wonderful morning looking at the Dutch masters, and to my mind, painting never got any better than that. Thank you for your gift of that. And I think this captures the melancholy, the healing, the light shining in as a metaphor for what music can do to lift our spirits. Beliefs about music's power to heal the mind, the body, and the spirit date back to the Upper Paleolithic era, around 20,000 years ago, when ancient shamans used drumming in the hopes of curing a wide range of maladies, from mental disorders to wounds and illnesses. The shamanistic traditions almost always involved percussion and drumming, as depicted in the Sufis dancing here. And one of the things that characterized ancient healing was a beat, some kind of a rhythmic pulse. And we now believe that that was able to facilitate the induction of a trance state. People more easily fall into a trance when there's a regular beat. A trance state isn't required for music therapy to work, but it was common. And one of the things the trance state can do is put us in an altered state of consciousness, which allows our bodies to access more effective immune function. And I'll return to that in a moment. But why does the trance state occur? Well, we now know that there are neurons in the brain, huge populations of millions of them, that fire in synchrony to whatever the tempo is. And I'll return to that in a moment also. 20 or 30 years ago, if you read about music as medicine, it seemed like it was pseudoscience. It wasn't taken seriously. There weren't very good studies being done. The ubiquity of neuroimaging, the larger number of people who have entered the field, and the rigor that was insisted upon by peer-reviewed journals did give us a literature that is quite solid now. And you started seeing musical findings in some of the biggest journals there were. It's no longer a folk science. And one of the best examples that we know of is the ability of music to reduce anxiety. In a set of studies, listening to music prior to surgery was found to be as effective as diazepam, Valium, in reducing stress or anxiety. Now, how does this work? If you were to undergo a major surgery where you were to be put under, you know, major sedation, before they sedate you, they typically give you a muscle relaxant, a physiological relaxant like Valium, because it turns out that being relaxed is different than being knocked out. And if your blood pressure is lower and your respiration is more stable, independent of the general anesthesia, you're going to recover more quickly. And this is what they found, that the patients who got the relaxing music, music the patient themselves had chosen as relaxing, because everybody likes different things, the outcomes during surgery and post-surgery were far superior with the music. Now, from a cost standpoint, we've got spiraling healthcare costs. A typical Valium that you would get at the corner drugstore might cost €5 for the brand name, less for the generic. But in hospital settings, that same volume can cost 500 euros. It's a profit center for hospitals. It's like the alcohol at a restaurant. It's where they make their money. So why not spend $15 on a Spotify subscription and not $500 on the pill? We've seen effects of music on body and brain chemistry. In particular, immunoglobulin A increases following music therapy. IgA is an important antibody needed for fighting infections of the mucosal system, like COVID. Epinephrine and norepinephrine increase following music therapy. They affect alertness and arousal. And melatonin, which helps to regulate sleep and waking cycles, is produced when you listen to relaxing music. And it's associated with increased cytokine production. And for those of you that don't remember your first year science course from university, cytokine in turn signals the T cells to travel to the site of an infection, all from listening to relaxing music. Stress, as you know, is associated with increased risk of coronary heart disease. We now know that patients who listen to joyful music showed a significant increase in arterial dilation to a level obtained with aerobic therapy or a statin. Statins have about a 15% risk of debilitating side effects. We've never heard of any debilitating side effects from music, other than the one time when Manuel Noriega was driven out of his compound by Van Halen music being blasted at him at 140 decibels. Thank you, US Army. We often think of music as pleasurable. It is a language of emotion. And so one of the first questions our laboratory asked was, what are the neural correlates of musical pleasure, the neural codes? What's the math going on in the brain that leads to the emotional reactions? And our lab was the first to show that when you listen to music, again, music that you like, that you've chosen, it activates a well-known reward center of the brain. Now, up to this point, up to about 2003, most studies in neuroscience of emotion focused on negative emotions like fear and anxiety. The few positive studies of emotion tended to focus on drugs of addiction to induce the positive emotions. We wondered about naturally occurring positive emotions, like listening to a comedy record or looking at paintings, listening to music. And so we showed that dopamine was released in these key areas of the reward network. When people listen to music, the same areas of the brain that are activated when you're hungry and you get to eat, when you're thirsty and you get to drink, when you have sex, when you eat chocolate, all those kinds of things. Music activates that same pleasure center. We also showed, by the way, that Professor Honing was talking about how music may have preceded language. We observed many cases where infants begin musical babbling before they begin speech babbling. And in a companion to this study, we found in 2003 that music and language are processed in different areas of the brain. Actually, to be more precise, that's what we said back then. Now we don't think of them as areas, but as circuits. They're processed in overlapping circuits in the brain. What about chronic pain? Another big complaint. The chief complaint that people have when they go to the doctor is, doctor, it hurts here. 80% of doctor visits are about pain. Our lab was the first to show that the brain produces its own opioids in response to listening to music. Think about that. The opioids aren't produced at sufficient levels to equal, say, oxycodone or codeine or heroin, but in sufficient levels that you probably wouldn't need those in the first place. You could get by with music and maybe an aspirin or a Tylenol. I'd like to go over some medical applications of music and in particular some case studies. I mentioned that music and language are processed in different circuits. And based on that idea, a therapy was developed called melodic intonation therapy. And it scaffolds on the idea that speech is phylogenetically newer, that is, we're scaffolding speech on phylogenetically older, that is, evolutionarily older, music circuits, the music circuits that probably pre-existed language. And as more evidence for that, a point that Professor Honig made so eloquently, when we look at ancient burial sites of humans and Neanderthals, the oldest artifacts we find there are musical instruments. They're bone flutes, things of that nature, 40,000 to 60,000 years ago. And we assume, we infer, that before somebody thought of going to all the trouble of carving holes in a bone, a bear femur or whatever it was, they probably were banging on their chest, Bobby McFerrin style, or they were banging on drums or hitting logs together for tens of thousands of years before that. So melodic intonation therapy teaches people to sing the requests that they can no longer make if they've suffered brain damage that takes away their speech, so-called aphasias. The most famous case of that in my country was when Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot in Tucson in 2011. The bullet went into her brain, and she was no longer able to speak because her speech centers were damaged. But within 18 months of being shot, she regained speech through this melodic intonation therapy. She was taught to sing things like, "I need a glass of water," or "show me to the bathroom." She could sing just fine, and then the trick was that through the repetition of singing, new brain circuits were developed. Neuroplasticity is what it's called. And she was eventually able to speak just fine. I'm going to show you a video of her taken in a therapy session. And I'd like to caution that this is a little bit difficult to watch because she's at the beginning of the therapy, and at one point she gets so frustrated that she winces and cries when she's trying to speak. But then look what happens. Incidentally, this is narrated, this video, by Bob Woodruff, a journalist who also suffered brain damage while covering a story in Iraq. And it was just a nice little synergy there. He reported on Gabby's recovery. At this point, she could not say the word light, but she could sing it, and a whole lot more.
Now, in those early therapy sessions in Houston,
you turn on the light.
It seemed as though words had abandoned her.
Let's try this one. Watch me.
Yes.
Turn on the...
For those of us injured on the left side of the brain, our loss of words can make us feel trapped inside our own minds.
Gabby, are you frustrated?
And then, in this emotionally charged moment, to our absolute amazement, we heard this.
Okay, you're gonna do this. You ready?
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
Isn't that extraordinary? Melodic intonation therapy.
Now in those...
Here's another example of that. This is a video from my friend Bob Knight at UC Berkeley, who's been studying patients with inability to speak. And this woman just brought her father in, who was a professor at UC Berkeley and had a stroke and could no longer speak. And they're discovering this for the first time. I have permission to use this from the patient and from the Bob. And what you're going to see off camera is Bob's postdoctoral fellow who's just arrived in the lab and is looking for a research project. And Bob says, well, this is going to be your project. Look at this. It's another extraordinary example.
Try this, okay? Do you have grandchildren?
No. They have with
Not nearby.
Not nearby.
Yeah.
Not nearby.
Yeah.
So you must have been, let's try happy birthday. Okay, ready? With me, ready?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Stephen.
He's one of your research subjects. He can sing, right?
Yeah.
She this is an old, he basically can sing and he has, now say the words.
No, that chance. Happy birthday to.
There's your signature patient.
To booster.
He eventually learned to speak.
Try this. So.
I want to shift now and talk about aging. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to tell you a story about my grandmother, who was an immigrant to the United States from Germany. This is her with my mother. And on her 80th birthday, my mother and I took her out to lunch, and we asked her what she'd been doing, and she said, well, I sang God Bless America this morning because the country took me in, a song written by another immigrant, by the way, Irving Berlin. And she said, I sing it every single morning. I'm so grateful that the country took us in from the Nazis. And so my mother went and I went to Radio Shack, a store in the States, and we bought her a little $80 keyboard, electronic keyboard, and she'd never played an instrument. And I taped numbers on the keyboard so she'd know what to play. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And she played that song, and we saw her a few months later, and she'd removed the tape because she had learned where all the notes are. And by her 81st birthday, she had worked out a rudimentary harmony with the left hand. And by her 82nd birthday, she was improvising a little bit. She played it every morning with a great sense of purpose until she died at 97. It's never too late to learn an instrument, and it's one of the most neuroprotective things that we know of. Learning an instrument requires a lot of eye-hand coordination. It gives you a sense of agency. And imagine that just for a few minutes, you can put your fingers on the piano in the same place that Chopin put them. And you can be Chopin for a few minutes or longer. Never too late to learn. We've seen a lot of demonstrations of that. Now, with the other side of aging, Alzheimer's and dementia, often patients lose the ability to recognize loved ones. They don't know where they are. They become agitated, and they may not even recognize themselves in a mirror. This state is so profoundly disorienting to them that they often fold in on themselves and stop communicating because nothing in the world makes sense. This is an excerpt from a film many of you may have seen called Alive Inside, where my colleague Oliver Sacks is meeting with Henry, a patient on a ward who had collapsed into himself because he couldn't make sense of anything, and Oliver brings him an iPod.
This is Henry. He's 94, a resident of this Brooklyn nursing home for the past 10 years.
And he used to always sit on the unit with his head like this.
Henry always loved music, but dementia left him a shell of himself.
We first see Henry inert and almost unalive.
But watch what happens when he's given some of his favorite music.
And immediately he lights up and he's being animated by the music.
And even when the music stops, the transformation continues.
What does music do to you?
Give me the feeling of love, romance. Because right now the world needs to come into music.
He has remembered who he is through the power of music.
What's your favorite Cab Calloway song?
Oh, I'll be home there for Christmas.
After this kind of treatment, just listening to music for 20 minutes, patients who had been unresponsive for months become reattached to that part of themselves they had lost, their history, their childhood, their desires, their beliefs. Why? Because human memory and animal memory, as far as we know, works on a principle that the first memories in are the last ones that you lose. They're the most resilient. So the music that we had in our childhood is the stuff that we're going to hold on to the longest. So be careful what your children listen to, because that's going to be the last thing they really can make sense of when they're old. But the idea of reconnecting with yourself reinvigorates them in a way that they can then start communicating and relating to the world for another couple of weeks. just from 20 minutes of music. And then they get another dose of music.
This is how
Parkinson's disease is probably the very best evidence that we have for the effectiveness of music therapy. And this is an epidemic because Parkinson's is a disease of aging. We're an aging population. There's also toxins in the environment. But we're seeing a lot more cases of Parkinson's. One of the things that accompanies Parkinson's is an inability to control voluntary movements or initiate voluntary movements. And so you see people with Parkinson's who have the shakes, and at some point many of them lose the ability to walk. It's because the timing circuit in the brain that's keeping track of how to make one movement follow another, one foot has to follow the other, and they have to be in sequence, otherwise both are up at the same time or both are down at the same time. Parkinson's patients often freeze, and they cannot walk. And a loss of mobility is profoundly debilitating to your quality of life. And so what Michael Tout and University of Toronto and others discovered, if you play music to people with Parkinson's, remember I mentioned at the beginning that you've got millions of neurons that synchronize to the tempo? So if you play music with the tempo of a person's natural gait, their walking speed, within about 5 seconds, those neurons which are intact, as opposed to the ones that were destroyed by the disease, those kick in, and the brain is a giant synchronizing device, and the movements automatically synchronize to those intact circuits. Here's a video of a patient who's being given this therapy. So you can see he's in a walker. That white band around his middle is a typical thing for aging patients. He starts to fall, she grabs him by that. Now here comes the music. He's getting the tempo. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. Now he doesn't even have the walker. Look at that bounce in his step. This is transformative. It's taking a bunch of people who could not move and allowing them to move. And 20 minutes a day of this rhythmic auditory stimulation for a week or two can have benefits for 6 or 8 weeks because, again, like in the case of Gabby Giffords, the brain wants to repair itself. You just need to give it a little nudge. You're building up new neural circuits as you practice this, and that's the effect. Another finding that I think is interesting and particularly relevant here in the Royal Palace is that when people listen to the same music, their brain waves literally synchronize. We showed this in our lab maybe 15 years ago, and they don't even have to be in the same room, but if they're listening to the same music, their brain waves synchronize. And if they're in the same room, even more so. And oxytocin, a neuropeptide associated with feelings of trust and bonding, is released in large amounts when people listen to music together, even more so when they sing together. And so the suggestion is that if you had people negotiating an agreement or a treaty and you put them in the same room and you got them to listen to music first, that might actually help. And famously, the Treaty at Versailles was signed after some Beethoven music that was commissioned just for that occasion was played. And I can't say that it was Beethoven that caused it, but it couldn't have hurt. I mentioned earlier the trance state. There's one of the major findings in neuroscience in the last 25 years is something called the default mode network. Normally, when you're going about your daily life, you have moments where you're paying close attention and moments where your mind wanders. Hopefully you're in the first mode right now, and you're engaged and you're not bored, but every once in a while your mind may drift. And you've all experienced this maybe when you're reading a book. You find that your eyes have gone two pages, but you don't remember what you just read, so you have to go back. That's the default mode, your brain's default, when you're not exerting attentional control and keeping it on task. And our lab showed that music is one of the most reliable ways to enter the default mode. It doesn't have to be trance music, but that helps. But classical music, jazz, music that sends you into a flight of fancy that you allow yourself to surrender to can ease the circuits that would normally be controlling your thoughts, and then let your thoughts move of their own volition from one to another. This is important because this default mode network is where a lot of problem solving gets done. You've all had the experience, you're at the grocery store and you're shopping for something, and suddenly, while you weren't thinking about it, the resolution to some problem comes to you. That's your default mode network figuring out problems in the background. So one of the other things we showed in this paper is we identified the location of the switch that moves you in and out of the default mode network when you listen to music. And it happens to be here in the center of the brain, about an inch below where my finger is, in a structure called the insula. Not that that means anything. I just figure if I use a big word like that, it makes me sound authoritative. And actually giving it a name doesn't explain anything, but you know, that's the way science works. We name things. But it is important that we know that there is such a switch, and music's not, I don't want to overstate the case for music. Music's not the only way to get in that mode. Meditation, going for a walk, especially in nature, sitting at the beach and looking out at the water, taking a nap, all those things will do the same thing. That was that paper there. This is Francis Collins, who was the director of the National Institutes of Health in the United States and then led the White House Science Office until the current administration. And he envisions a world where we can be solving health problems with music rather than drugs, providing therapy that is spiritually uplifting and joyful. What are the features of music? When I say we have to listen to music and it can help us, or when I talk about music therapy, is it the pitch? Is it the rhythm? Is it the tempo? The timbre? The lyrics? The genre? What is it that has the biggest effect? Well, it depends. If you're talking about healing effects, slower tempos tend to be more relaxing. But if it's too slow, you might grow impatient. Faster tempos tend to be arousing, unless they're so fast that your mind can't keep up. The lyrics are less important than you might think. One of the most beloved songs of the last 90 years, Mack the Knife, is about a serial killer. But it's, you know, it's so jaunty, people don't seem to mind. But what it really comes down to is there is no one song that everybody likes. There's no one song everybody hates. It's very personal. Our musical taste is personal, and so music therapy works best when we have an opportunity to choose the music that moves us. And that may not be the same music from day to day, but there is now a scientific basis for understanding some of the components of music that will lead to these various therapeutic results. And we're now able to recommend music that will lower your blood pressure or that will arouse you so that you don't fall asleep while you're long distance driving, music that will help with pain, music that will help with depression. There's no one size fits all. It depends on your goals, and licensed certified music therapists often help patients to pick out their music that will be having the healing effect. But what we know is that most people in Western countries are already using music as a kind of medicine. They know what kind of music to reach for in the morning when they're trying to get out of bed. They know what kind of music to listen to get them through a workout or to help soothe them after a conflict at work or a fight or something like that. And I would say, you know, people are always asking, well, is rap music bad? Is classical music better? There's no difference in the brain to those different kinds of music, as long as you like the music. Thank you very much. Thank you.